Well, stand by, because our program tonight has none other than Jim Mars with us. We're going to talk about secret societies. If you don't think they're out there, think again. Wait until you hear what Mr. Mars has to say. Jim Mars in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jim Mars is an award-winning journalist, more than 30 years' experience with several Texas newspapers. In 1999, he began teaching a course on UFOs, perhaps one of the first university-level UFO courses in the nation. Jim also investigated the U.S. Army's remote viewing program 3 years before it was publicly acknowledged by the CIA, and then he produced Alien Agenda. In addition, his book, Rule by Secrecy, has been termed an underground bestseller. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Jim, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
Hey, George, it's a pleasure to be with you and your audience, as always.
Likewise, likewise. Hey, I got to get your reaction to the release of these two videotapes by the Defense Department today.
Don't you love the timing?
Yeah.
Don't you love the timing? President Bush's approval ratings are dipping into the 20s, the 9/11 truth movement is gaining steam all the time. And all of a sudden, the Pentagon decides they're going to release 14 frames instead of 5, as they did earlier, and we're going to get to see the plane hit the Pentagon. And, of course, the major corporate media pundits are all out there echoing and parroting each other, saying, well, I guess this takes care of the conspiracy theorist. Well, I've seen it, and I'm underwhelmed, okay? All I see is an explosion at the Pentagon.
And something that is not particularly large, zoom right into it.
Exactly. Look more like a cruise missile to me, but then what do I know? I guess I'm just a conspiracy theorist, but what I do know is the timing is just immaculate. Every time the truth is about to emerge, we all get diverted with some other little tidbit. Now, here's the thing, George. Okay, they've released the film of the plane hitting the Pentagon. Great. Okay, now let's see the security camera films from the Sheraton Hotel, the Citgo Station, and several other places that the FBI confiscated that day and has never been shown to the public. Why not?
Exactly.
We get to see this film of the something hitting the Pentagon. Let's just see all of them hitting the Pentagon, and then maybe we'll figure out what really happened.
Yep. It's almost as if they showed us the videos that would baffle us even more.
Exactly, except I think the purpose here, George, is that a great number of people are not going to take the time, the trouble, or even have the opportunity to really look at the film and try to make up their own mind. All they're going to hear is the sound bites and the headlines that say, film release showing the plane hitting the Pentagon, and they'll just go back to sleep and say, oh, well, see, that took care of that. And the pundits will help them along by saying, see, all those conspiracy theorists don't know what they're talking about.
Well, and I got to tell you, Jim, you know, I've been a newsman all my life. You've been a newsman for years. The fact that they would say, I mean, these two clips that don't really show anything, the fact that they would say we can't release these because of the Zacharias Moussaoui trial, I mean, what did those clips have to do with the trial?
Nothing. Although there was at least one media outlet that reported that the Moussaoui jury got to see a film of the plane hitting the Pentagon, and that kind of made the rounds. And from what I understand, this apparently is the same thing they saw. And if I was sitting on that jury, I mean, number one, Moussaoui was in custody on 9/11, so he certainly physically and directly didn't have anything to do with it. And I don't know. I wouldn't be that impressed with all this either, but I'm with you, George. Why keep all this secret? And, you know, here's another thing. You know as well as I do, being a longtime newsman, that after every major air disaster, the National Transportation Safety Board conducts an investigation, and they take every little scrap and piece of debris from that airplane, and they take it to some big hangar or warehouse,
and they try to rebuild it.
Yep, yeah, they reassemble it to find out what happened. Okay, show me a picture of Flight 77. pieced back together. And let's follow this one, George. This to me is just amazing. Early on, the first reports were that the plane hit the ground and ricocheted into the Pentagon. Okay, now the problem, then they ran into a problem because some of the first responders and some of the firemen who heard the crash and raced to the scene without being called had digital cameras with them. And so they were taking pictures around there, and before long, those pictures ended up on the Internet. Well, we see this perfectly green lawn right in front of the Pentagon. So obviously nothing hit that. So the story changed. The story changed, and it became, well, this fully loaded 757 punched right through a hole in the Pentagon. The wings folded back, the tail folded back, the tail fins folded back, landing gear, you know, all of this just went right through this hole, burst into flames, and disintegrated. There's nothing left. No
engine. And the other thing, too, Jim, you know, I've talked to a number of pilots before. If that hole was created by that plane, and that's a big if, and it's put in quotation marks,
mm-hmm.
but if it was, in order for the plane to create that kind of a hole, it had to have flown about a foot or two off the ground for God knows how long for that impact. This wasn't an impact from an angle.
No, it was dead on. And so the story then became that, well, it just disintegrated, right? They don't have any pieces. There was just a few little pieces. We've all seen the photograph of the little shard of metal laying on the grass there, but I might point out that that little piece of metal that we've all seen that picture of and everybody points to and say, well, there's a piece of aircraft, and it even had red paint on it. But that piece of metal was not there in the earliest photographs, okay? Now, the next thing is that the plane disintegrated. But then, a few weeks later, the FBI comes out and says, okay, it's all taken care of. We've identified the passengers on Flight 77 from their fingerprints.
Fingerprints.
The plane disintegrates into a ball of fire, and those huge turbine engines are destroyed, but they've got fingerprints. So that caused the FBI to have to back up again and say, oh, well, we've got pieces of the airplane, and it's all stored away at this warehouse somewhere, undisclosed location. Okay, fine. Show me a picture of that. Just show me a picture of the pieces of the airplane. What's wrong with that? How's that going to change anything? And how's that going to affect the outcome of anything? Certainly wouldn't affect the outcome of the Missouri trial, would it?
Well, and you would think if they wanted to convince us that this plane indeed did hit the Pentagon, that they would release exactly the tapes you and I have been talking about for these last several years.
Exactly. Just show us the tapes. We'll see it hit, and then we'll all know what happened.
Yep.
By the way, I'll give you a little advance word. I have a new book coming out on 9/11 called The Terror Conspiracy. It's due out in September. And Barbara Honegger, the Pentagon worker and the author of October Surprise, has done some excellent work, and she's written an appendix for this book. And in there, she points out that originally we were told that whatever hit the Pentagon hit it about 9:48, and then they backed it back to 9:47, and they now have it down to around 9:37. Well, what's with the Jimmy and with the time? She points out quite correctly that these clocks in the hallways of the Pentagon and at the heliport all stopped with the explosion at 9:31 point whatever. So we'll say 9:32. Okay, so there's a 5-minute gap there. And what's this about? Well, she interviewed General Larry Arnold of NORAD, who told her that after something blew up at the Pentagon, he ordered an F-15 to buzz the Pentagon to see what had happened, and the pilot reported back that he didn't see any evidence of an airplane. This happened after the event, and the F-15 made a steep 180-degree spiraling dive, leveled out, and zoomed in at treetop level past the west wall of the Pentagon. George, that was what they've got on the radar. Okay? And that's what they're saying. Well, we got the radar track. It was Flight 77. But it was an F-15. And this flight past the Pentagon occurred several minutes after something blew up at the Pentagon.
Wasn't that area also an area that was being remodeled or was going to be remodeled?
Yes, it was. And I might point out that either the day before or 2 days before 9/11, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld had admitted that the Pentagon could not account for $2.3 billion. And so you know there was going to be a big investigation. And who would have conducted all of the audit work? The U.S. Army Accounting Office, which happened to be one of the hardest hit when the Pentagon was struck. And so,
very interesting.
Isn't that interesting? See, you have to put these things together because they don't happen in a vacuum. It's not
now,
like
what do you tell? What do you tell people who go ballistic, who jump up and down, and they say, you guys are just conspiracy wackos. None of this is true. Why are you making this up?
Well, let me tell you the wackiest conspiracy theory that I've ever heard, and that is that 19 Muslim fanatics armed with pocket knives can simultaneously commandeer, hijack four commercial airliners and turn their transponders off all at the same moment and then crash them into prominent structures, especially the Pentagon, the most heavily defended building in the world, without even triggering the automatic anti-aircraft missile batteries, and all the while being controlled by another Muslim cleric using a laptop in a cave in Afghanistan. Now, that's about the most ridiculous conspiracy theory I've ever heard. And, George, you know it is a theory because none of that's been proven. In fact, half of those hijackers that the FBI still claim were the attackers on 9/11 and that were named by the 9/11 Commission have been reported still alive in the Middle East.
I've heard that. I've also heard from pilots who have said there is no way that people would be trained on Cessnas or in small planes in these pilot schools that they were in, flight schools, and then fly those huge jets.
Absolutely.
That there's no way. They'd have to be on. They'd have to be on simulators, and if they were on simulators, that means somebody was very complicit with them to train them.
Exactly. And Hundi Hanjour, who they claim is the pilot of Flight 77 and crashed it in the Pentagon, was actually turned down from renting a Cessna 150 because he wasn't competent enough to even fly that little private plane.
I know.
The whole thing's just nuts. But I'll tell you what we're doing now. We're closing in on the topic for tonight. I might point out that just today in the Senate, on a close 55-40 vote, they crossing party lines, they have are now supporting the immigration legislation without any of the provisions for tightened security on the border. And guess who is in league on all of this? President Bush said, here's what we need to do. We have to have this amnesty program, et cetera, et cetera. And he's backed up by Senator Edward Kennedy. So if that doesn't prove to you that there is a cross-party line agenda going on here. Now, see, I'm old enough to remember in 1965 when President Lyndon Johnson and a big end of the immigration thing came up, as it has probably for the last 100 years, and he offered an amnesty program, okay? And what happened was is that we had double the amount of illegal entries coming into this country. And then during the Reagan administration, they offered an amnesty program, and what happened? The illegal immigration doubled again. So that's all we're going to get is more of this. Now, why now, George? Why now? There has been some rhetoric about tightening security on the borders. Why didn't they do that 5.5 years ago when we were told that we're under attack and that we're in a war on terrorism and that Al-Qaeda is trying to slip weapons of mass destruction into this country?
Should have been one of the first things.
Democracy.
Should have been one of the first things we did as a nation.
That's an elementary step, is to secure the border, but it hasn't happened. It's not happening now, and now they're talking about this amnesty program and letting everybody that's in here already in here, yada, yada, yada. Okay, does that not prove? That proves to me that the war on terrorism is a fraud, okay? Because if there was truly terrorists out there hell-bent on attacking our nation and slipping weapons and bombs and suitcase nukes into this country, the first fundamental step would be to tighten security on the border, but it hasn't happened.
Well,
and they're only just now talking about it because the rank and file, the grassroots Americans, have finally said, what is with this? And they don't, and nobody understands it, you know. We're supposed to be fearful of the war of the terrorists on the one hand, and yet our borders are wide open. And by the way, George, let me point out that a couple of weeks ago, the Texas media had a story about they did a study of the arrest made by the Border Patrol, and they found out 65% of those arrested by the Border Patrol over like the past year were not Mexicans. They came and they represented people from 72 different nations.
My God.
Okay, now come on, folks. The whole thing's a joke. It really is. I mean, it's a sick joke because people lost their lives and we're losing our freedoms. And gasoline prices are still going up, even though we supposedly went in to take over Iraq's oil supply. Oh, no, wait a minute. That's not right. We went in there to get those weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be fraudulent.
I still think you're going to have $100 oil a barrel. Easy.
Well, it's slipped back a little bit now, but it was up over 70, and so I think you're right, George. I think it's heading in that direction. All they, what they do is, though, is that they're going to let us get used to that, to this $70 barrel gasoline, and then when everybody kind of goes back to sleep, quits thinking about it, then they'll kick it up again. It's really amazing. So, and people can't, they disconnect on this, you know? We got to have the war and freedom on the one hand, and we got to protect the nation, and on the other hand, there's no security.
Well,
at the border.
And you talk about the inconsistencies. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, we get this horrible thing happened to us in 2001. We don't secure the borders. We're concerned about weapons of mass destruction. We're concerned about nuclear weapons coming into this country. And what do? We give a Chinese, communist Chinese government-controlled company the right to inspect cargo in the Bahamas, where a lot of our East Coast cargo comes from. It doesn't make any sense.
And let's not forget that Congress got upset because a company that was government-owned by Dubai, a nation that with known terrorist ties, was going to operate 23 of our major ports.
And by the way,
Congress said, no, wait a minute, we got to look at this. President Bush threatened to veto them.
And as I predicted, by the way, 3 months ago, that thing is going to skate through. That Dubai company claims they're going to sell the lease rights to some other company to take the heat off them.
Right.
And they haven't done one thing yet, Jim.
No, they're just waiting for everybody to forget about it, and then
exactly.
They'll just go right on. Now,
exactly.
Why is all this disconnect happening? And I'll tell you why. Read my book, Rule by Secrecy, okay? The underground bestseller. What we find out is that this country is now under the control of secret society members who are self-avowed globalists. They do not want nation states. They do not want sovereign boundaries. They want a borderless world of nothing but free trade zones, okay? And that's why, and once you understand who these people are, what they want, and what their game plan is, it all falls into place. But otherwise, you're out there squabbling about liberal and conservative and Republican and Democrat and this, that, and the other thing, and you're distracted and you're divided, and these people are pushing their agenda right on through.
And in order to break down those borders, you need to create fear and panic.
Exactly. And keep people so fearful that they don't dare raise objections to what you're doing. Let's go back to 2004.
Hold that thought, Jim. We're going to take this break, all right?
All
right. Hold that thought. We'll come right back. We'll talk more about secret societies. I knew you were going to get going, but I didn't know that much. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, you were talking about 2004 as we were discussing secret societies.
Right. I can remember during the Cold War, we used to laugh at the Soviet Russia because when they had a presidential election, they put up one candidate. You could either vote for him or not, right? And we thought that was pretty silly. But then look at 2004. We had the choice of George W. Bush, an oil man and a member of Skull and Bones, Or we could vote for his cousin, John Kerry, the Democrat, who was an oil man and a member of Skull and Bones. So it's all of a sudden, it's like, wait a minute, that's pretty much just like what they had in Russia, except we get a choice, but there's really not a choice. And on page 93 of my book, Ruled by Secrecy, I point out that back in the 1980s, when they had the scandal over the Bank for Credit and Commerce, the BCCI.
Oh, yeah, that what a disaster that was.
Exactly. And the name of the Bush family kept coming up, particularly George Herbert Walker Bush. And finally, the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Terrorism, Narcotics, and International Operations was formed to look into it, and guess who chaired that? John Kerry. And John Kerry said, well, I don't really see any wrongdoing here. And yet Jack Bloom, a special counsel to the subcommittee, said, quote, I proposed a serious investigation of BCCI and was brushed aside. A high-level cover-up of everything concerning BCCI was set into place after Customs stumbled across their money laundering operation in Miami, and it's still in place.
Wasn't
so
the BCCI
covered for the Bushes during that big scandal, and then he runs against George W. for president. And why did he cover? Because they're both Skull and Bonesmen, a secret society, and they pledged a blood oath years ago when they were both in college that they would support, defend, and cover for their brothers. Now, George, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but it's worrisome to me that we have a man as commander-in-chief of our armed forces and as the chief executive of this country who has taken an oath that supersedes to a secret society that supersedes every other oath he'll take, including the one he took to the Constitution of the United States. Now, that bothers me.
Well, also the fact that we don't really know what this society does. We don't know. I mean, they keep it very, very confidential.
Yes, but the new article in New Yorker investigated Skull and Bones and found out that it was simply a chapter of a German secret society. Chapter 322. And what was that German secret society? The Illuminati. And now we're back into even other deeper, darker secret societies.
And this is the worldwide power. It's not just here.
Oh, no, it's worldwide. That's why David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski formed the Trilateral Commission in 1972 to broaden the scope of just the Atlantic nations, industrial nations, to include the emerging Asian economies. Trilateral meaning Asia, North America, and Europe.
The societies go back how far? Thousands of years?
Oh, George, I'm sure that when they were just cavemen tribes wandering around, in fact, this has been documented, and in ancient primitive cultures, the hunters would all go off by themselves, you know, and drink and carouse and bond, you know. So I'm sure there's secret societies that have been with us forever and ever. I was in a college fraternity. We have secret societies, the Masons in this country, and on like that. And all secret societies are not necessarily vile and evil. But the problem is that in my book, Rule by Secrecy, I can track the inner core elite, these globalists, right back through earlier secret societies, Council on Foreign Relations, formed by Illuminati Freemasons. Freemasons were infiltrated by the Illuminati and the Freemasons, and others like the Teutonic Knights were basically the creation of the legendary Knights Templars. Mm-hmm. The Knights Templars gained all of their secret information by excavating under the old Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem after it was captured during the First Crusade. And all of that knowledge had been brought out of Egypt by Moses and was brought into Egypt the first place by the biblical patriarch Abraham, who came from Ur of Chaldea. And Chaldea was simply a biblical term for the Mesopotamia between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, which today we know as Iraq. The one place on this planet that none of us free Americans can really go to unless we're in uniform.
Well, that's true. The Templar, did they get Solomon's treasures?
Yes, they did. In fact, let's trace Solomon's treasure, and I'm going to drop a bombshell on you tonight because I'm going to tell you what happened to it.
All right.
All right, let's go back to the time of Moses, and when he brings the Israelites out of Egypt, they dragged along everything they could carry, and then they spent 40 years going through the wilderness, defeating one city-state after another. And as was the custom of the time, when you defeated your enemy, you took everything he had, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was loot.
Mm-hmm.
And so after a while, I'm sure they got pretty tired schlepping all that treasure around through the desert. So eventually King Solomon built his temple on the Temple Mount there in Jerusalem, or what became Jerusalem. Now, if you go back and study that, you'll find that their worship area was just a little bitty room back towards the back, and the whole front part of it was just this big old huge barn-like affair. What was that for? To house all this wealth, gold, silver, precious stones, statuary, but they also had treasure of knowledge, ancient knowledge, scrolls and texts that had been handed down for centuries. So what happened to that? Well, at the time of the Jewish revolt in 70 AD, when they tried to throw the Romans out, they must have known the Romans weren't going to put up with that. And sure enough, Jerusalem was sacked by the Romans. But the Jews knew they were coming, and so they probably took the better part of the treasure. Now, you don't take it all, or they'll keep looking for it, right?
Right.
But they took the better part of it, and they buried it away in the catacombs under the King Solomon's temple, sealed it all up like there's nothing down there. And then, of course, by that time, it was not Solomon's temple. It was the palace of King Herod, but it was built on the same location. So they hid away a portion of the treasure, but the Romans got a good portion, and they hauled it back to Rome as war booty. 400 years later, Alaric the Goth sacked Rome. And he got hold of this same treasure, and he took it back to his home stomping grounds, the Languedoc region of southern France, okay, in the area of Rennes-la-Château, Monseigneur, and they buried it down in those cavern systems down there in the foothills of the Pyrenees. Okay, now the people who lived there then had access to this, not only some riches, but also this information, and that's what gave rise to the very mysterious Cathars, who were at loggerheads with the Church of Rome. And they said, you guys don't have the right story. We know what really went on because they had the documents and the text hidden away. And the Pope knew that they could have been a real threat to the early church, so he ordered up the Albigensian Crusade. And they sent a papal army into the Languedoc region, and they killed every Cathar that they could find. That's where the famous line came from, by the way. The general, when he was surrounding the city of Brazeres, sent a message back to the Pope, and he said, how am I going to tell the Cathars from everybody else? And the Pope sent word back to him and said, kill them all and let God sort it out.
Oh, my God.
Okay? And they did. And that area today even is very underpopulated, okay? So the Cathars went underground and became some of the aristocratic families of what became France. The Sinclairs, the Hopoles, and these various families. And these were the very people who fomented the First Crusade, okay, along with their cousin, religious leader. And they, of course, they were going to bring freedom and democracy to the Middle East, so off they go. Really, they were after the rest of the treasure, because I don't know this, but I feel very confident that they had one of those copper scrolls, you know, that was kind of an inventory list. So
right.
They knew that the rest, the best part of the Solomon's treasure, was still buried under the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. But it was in the hands of the Muslims. So they go over there and they capture the city. And right after that comes these nine knights who said, who were all either members of these families or their minions, and they got King Baldwin of Jerusalem to ordain them as a military order, the Poor Knights of the Temple, which became known as the Knights Templars. Their avowed purpose was to protect travelers to Jerusalem, but how can nine knights do that? What they did, and this is known because of British excavations in the 1800s, is these knights, Templars, were tunneling and excavating under the old Temple of Solomon.
They were looking for the treasure.
Exactly. And apparently they found it because they hauled it back to Europe again, back to the area of southern France, and Solomon's treasure then was reunited, and with the wealth that they brought back, and with the knowledge they brought back, the Knights Templars became one of the most powerful organizations the world has ever seen, and soon was rivaling the Roman Church. The Knights Templars were the first to use magnetic compasses on their ships. They brought back life-saving techniques such as artificial respiration. They built a huge fleet that rivaled any in the world. And this might interest you. The naval ensign of the Knights Templars was a black flag with a white skull and crossbones on it. Okay? So what we think of as the rollicking good old pirates, arg, matey, they were really the remnants of the Knights Templars fleet, and they raided primarily the Catholic countries because this was the war between the Templars and the Vatican that continued on up into the 1700s. But the treasure now is hidden away in southern France. But when the Templars were then condemned as heretics, and the Pope, along with the French king, moved against them in 1307 on that ill-fated day, Friday the 13th, that's where we get the...
That's how we get that. Huh?
That's where we get the bad vibes for Friday the 13th. Well, they didn't really get that many of them. All of them kind of ran off, and they all left, and they escaped, and the Templar fleet got away, became pirates. The good portion of the Templars went to Scotland because Robert the Bruce was friendly towards them, especially after the Battle of Brockbuck Burn when... A Templar contingent arrived and turned the tide of the battle, chased the English off, and secured Scotland's freedom. Y'all might remember that from the Mel Gibson movie.
Braveheart.
Braveheart, exactly. And so now they were secure, and history continued on, and the Hall of Solomon's treasure was hidden away in the Languedoc region, which leads us to the story in the late 1800s of the small village priest at Rennes-la-Château who discovered some genealogies and some coded documents when he was refurbishing his little church there, his little local church, chapel.
This sounds like a better movie than the Da Vinci Code.
Now we're into the Da Vinci Code. This is exactly what all they're talking about. And you have this mystery of Rennes-la-Château because suddenly this little poor village priest is hobnobbing with the Habsburgs, with the royalty of Europe. He becomes overnight suddenly rich and powerful, and then he suddenly dies, okay? And it was everybody was trying to find Solomon's treasure. Okay, and that's what the whole mystery of Rennes-la-Château is about. Not only a treasure of wealth, but a treasure of knowledge to include these genealogies that Dan Brown writes about in his book, The Da Vinci Code. Now, so what happened to Solomon's treasure? Okay, in the 1920s, a German student by the name of Otto Rahn wrote some books on the Cathars. He was very interested in them. And he traveled to southern France and did a lot of study and investigation. And it seems probable that he came across the location of Solomon's treasure. Maybe not precisely, but he began to pretty well pinpoint where it was located, which would have been in the area of Rennes-la-Château and Monseigneur, the last Cathar stronghold. And... by the late 30s, or by the early 30s, he had been recruited into the Nazi SS and became an SS officer.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently he didn't go along with the program because the word is that he really had kind of become converted to this Qathari belief and became pretty religious. And so the next thing we know, there was a small item in the German papers that said he had died in a hiking accident. But yet the best guess is that they threw him in the concentration camp, but not until they had picked his brain. But then they had a problem, see, because even after the Nazis overran France, they didn't control the whole country. They occupied northern France, but southern France was under the Vichy government and was known as Vichy France. And so they were trying to put out this front that this was, still France. And
right.
So the Germans weren't able to go in there. But then in September of 1943... the Italians, when the Allies invaded Italy, the Italians said, that's it, we're going to change sides. We're on the wrong side here.
Yeah.
And they grabbed Mussolini and they deposed him, okay? And they took Mussolini and hid him away in a mountaintop hotel where they were going to put him on and hold him until they could put him on trial. And
They ended up hanging him, didn't they?
Well, he ended up hanging at the end of the war. After he got caught, but right now this is 43, and they had him in this mountaintop hotel, and Hitler sends his top commando, Otto Skorzeny, okay, and some paratroopers, and in a daring daylight raid, they land on the mountaintop, they rescue Mussolini, they take him back to Hitler. Hitler proclaims Mussolini still the legitimate government of Italy. And the war continued in Italy right up until the surrender. We never did break through Italy completely. All right. Now, at that point, Hitler was figured he had room to move. He said, I've got to protect the soft underbelly of Europe, and he moved German troops into southern France. And in March 1944, Otto Skorzeny goes to Monsignor with a detachment of SS troops, and sends back a one-word telegram to Berlin that said, Eureka, which, of course, means I found it. And when I was in southern France a few years ago, there are still some old-timers who talk about convoys of trucks, even pack mule trains coming down out of the mountains and loading on sealed railroad cars that were then taken back to Berchtesgaden. The Nazis got Solomon's treasure.
The whole thing? All of it?
All of it. The United Treasure. Now, this may explain why, as you well know, and I'm sure you've had plenty of guests that have spoken about this, that at the end of the war, when we overran the Nazi research labs, they had flying saucers on the drawing board. They had three-stage rockets that were about ready to go. They were moving into even more exotic areas of research, such as energy manipulation.
You think those were some of the secrets and of the treasures of Solomon?
Very possibly so, because this does not reach the mainstream audience. I hear the music playing, let's continue this, and I will tell you why I believe that these documents and ancient texts may give us some very secret technology.
This is fascinating. We'll be back in a moment with Jim Mars on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, fascinating. So the Nazis pick up Solomon's treasure, and in it might include some incredible technology.
That's true. The Nazis were in Western Poland, apparently built a super collider superconductor, and they were working on energy manipulation. They had a device known as Degláka, or the bell. It was a bell-shaped device that created electromagnetic energy fields. And, the question becomes is, did they just come up with this on their own, or was this information that they had gleaned from these ancient technologies? And the question you asked before the break was, was any of this included in Solomon's treasure? And as I have already outlined for you and your listeners, all that information tracks all the way back to ancient Mesopotamia. Now, I have in my files the AP stories from 99, 2000, 2001 that French and German archaeological teams were making amazing new discoveries in Iraq. In fact, one German team using ground-penetrating radar believed that they had actually located the tomb of the legendary King Gilgamesh, who for the longest time was thought to be just some legend. But they are now saying that he probably was a real person and that that really existed. And what was this other amazing discoveries they were making? Well, we may not know, because where would they have taken all of those new found tablets and scrolls and texts? They would have taken them to the basement of the Iraqi National Museum in Baghdad. We all know, if you'll remember, that Saddam Hussein believed himself the reincarnated Nebuchadnezzar, mm-hmm. and he was rebuilding Babylon, so he obviously had an intense interest in these antiquities. And then, all of a sudden, we have to invade Iraq, okay? We're looking for weapons of mass destruction, but of course that's been proven to be wrong. Number one, we never found any. Number two, everyone who had knowledge of the situation, Hans Blix, the UN weapons inspector,
yeah.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, and even our own weapons inspector, Scott Ritter, before we invaded, said they don't have any, okay? But we went in anyway. We had to go, just had to go. And then we violated basic military strategy, which is to set yourself an objective, seize the objective, consolidate your winnings, secure the countryside, and move on to the next objective. No, we made a beeline for Baghdad, which is still creating problems for us now because we failed to pacify and secure the countryside.
And we never had an exit strategy.
And there was no exit strategy. And what happened once we got to Baghdad? The Iraqi National Museum was vandalized and looted. Okay? Now, I'm sure they hired a gang of looters. In fact, according to the reports, while there were a few hundred people running around and running into the museum, thousands of Iraqis were standing around shouting, "Don't do that. That's our national heritage. Stop
right.
what you're doing."
Exactly.
And even though museum directors from around the world had gained the promise from the Pentagon that we would protect the Iraqi National Museum, at one point, some American soldiers and a tank, I believe, actually were brought there and were trying to disperse the crowds, but they were only there for about 20 minutes before they were ordered out. And what happened then? The looting of the Iraqi National Museum. Now, Colonel Matthew Bagdanos investigated that looting for General Tommy Franks, and he stated that it's known that glass cutters were found in there that are not commercially available in Iraq. They bypassed expensive-looking fakes. The guards were suspiciously missing. They had keys to some of the vaults and some of the things. So this was an op. This was an operation.
And those things are gone now, aren't they?
Oh, well, now, some of the stuff in the upper museum that probably the hired mob got, a lot of those have been recovered, but listen to what Colonel Bagdanos said in a issue of Archaeology magazine. He said, the final group is from the basement. And, of course, the basement, George, is where they would have taken all the new recent finds, right? The basement is what we've been calling the inside job. And I will say it forever like a mantra. It is inconceivable to me that the basement was breached and the items stolen without an intimate insider's knowledge of the museum. And from there, about 10,000 pieces were taken, and we've only recovered approximately 650.
Oh, my gosh.
So this is where they got the good stuff. And what did it all have to do with? It had to do with this ancient technology, technology that probably goes back to the time of the building of the Great Pyramid, the mysterious structure at Baalbek, some of these really ancient, almost antediluvial type antiquities, and it all has to do with the manipulation of basic energy at the atomic and subatomic level, which now brings us to your favorite topic. That manipulation of energy is the basis for UFO technology. You've heard the stories, George, that when the UFO comes over, the car engines stop.
Yes.
And when the UFOs go away, the car engines start again.
Starts back up again.
Yeah, but have you ever heard anyone say, oh, yeah, and then the starter came on, and the engine started back? No, the starters don't start up. What happens is that when that UFO is in the area, you have an electromagnetic energy field which negates a lot of things, gravity for one thing. But if you can negate gravity, then according to quantum physics, you can probably negate time. And what happens is those engines simply freeze. The pistons come up, they stop, they freeze. And then when the energy field goes away, bam, they start banging away again. Now, this is some really exotic technology that many people feel like might open the door to anti-gravity, limitless free energy, perhaps interdimensional, and even time travel. And this, of course, is something that we would have to get our hands on. And since it would be potentially new weapons, then it has to be ultra secret. But the point is that people within these secret societies who trace their histories back through the Freemasons and to the Knights Templars, they know this stuff. They're interested in this stuff. In the late 1800s, when they were beginning to excavate these, what they thought were just mounds of dirt over in Iraq, and they found out that they were the ruins of these ancient Sumerian cities, who shows up to buy up a lot of the artifacts and some and the statuary, but John D. Rockefeller.
It's almost as if the big oil companies don't want us to know what's going on.
Of course they don't. They want, because there is the wealthy elite that lay at the heart of these secretive societies, and the reason they are the wealthy elite is because their wealth and hence their power is based on their control over monopolies.
How much
energy.
More money, Jim, do they need?
That's a good question. I mean, how wealthy do you have to be? But I think once we go in this direction and you keep following the evidence to its logical conclusion, there's something going on even deeper than just money.
I think so, too.
It is control, and it is control of the planet.
Is it ego on their part?
It goes beyond ego. It is an agenda. And, let's face it, a lot of them are in cahoots. The inner core elite of the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations, they meet once a year under the name Bilderberger. And the Bilderbergers are so secretive, they don't even have a proper name. They just call them the Bilderbergers because they were first discovered by the public meeting in 1954 at the Bilderberg Hotel in Holland. And one of the major founders of the Bilderbergers was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who had been a Nazi SS officer.
Jeez.
So, it just goes on and on and on. And then today we have President Bush, of course, as president. His father was George Herbert Walker Bush, and he had been president. And the patriarch of the family was Prescott Bush. And in late 1942, Prescott Bush was actually prosecuted by the U.S. government under the Trading with the Enemies Act and charged with being nothing but a financial front man for Hitler and the Nazis. So this goes very deep, it goes very widespread, and it's all very secretive. It's all rule by secrecy. And all of this is detailed. Of course, we're only hitting the high points. I'm just giving you kind of a straightforward explanation of, here's what it seems to be.
Sure. But it is remarkable how this is a worldwide situation, Jim. And it seems like these families are situated in every country on this planet.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you think they're all related somehow?
Well, let's go back to the 2000 election, and the very prestigious genealogical publication in England, Burke's Peerage, predicted that George W. Bush would be the next president of the United States. This was before the election. And how did they know that? They said because the Bush family was blood relatives to the Windsors, the ruling family of England.
England.
And that the Democratic candidate, and I'm getting a blank here, who did he run against in
Gore.
Al Gore. And that Al Gore's family was also related to the Windsors, the ruling family of England, but that the Bushes were more closely related to that bloodline, and that historically whoever was closest in the relationship to the royal bloodline of England got to be president of the United States. So they said George W. would be president, and sure enough, the Supreme Court decided he would be, and he was. And then that brings us to 2004, when he ran against his cousin, John Kerry, whose family also is in direct bloodline relationship to the Windsors. And the Windsors are not even English. They changed their name during World War One because of their German background. They are Germans. They were the Mountbattens, and then before that, they changed that to the Battenbergs, and they came from Germany.
The
so all of this, if you don't know your history, as George Santayana said, you are doomed to repeat it.
That's true, and you have to see how it unfolds. And what's so important, Jim, when you talk about a one-world government, on the face of it, if people aren't in the know, it's going to go right over their head. They're going to say this is preposterous. But then when you start to realize that all of them are intertwined with each other, then it makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. Exactly. And you can't listen to what any politician says. You have to watch what they do. Because, you know, politicians, well, let's face it, to get into public office in this country today, you just have to lie. You have to, or you won't get elected. It's unfortunate, but that's pretty much the state of affairs. And there they are, and they've got an agenda. They are globalist. They just want these free trade zones. And, of course, basically what we're talking about here probably is socialism, or more specifically, corporatism.
Let me be the devil's advocate for just a moment, Jim. So let's assume we get this one-world government.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with that?
Well, let me discuss that here. Philosophically, George, I am not opposed to one world government, okay? After all, we are one humanity. We occupy this one small planet going around a third-rate sun out on the outer fringe of the Milky Way galaxy. And I can perfectly well see that in the not-too-distant future, somebody's going to ask you, where are you from? And you're going to say, I'm from Earth.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
So philosophically, I really don't have any problem with this concept of this one world. The problem is that, number one, we're being pushed into it and connived into it through secrecy and deceit. Nobody ever got a chance to vote on the World Trade Organization, and yet because of decisions by the World Trade Organization, the United States Congress, it has had to change U.S. laws. Not because somebody thought it was a good idea or they did any study, but because they were ordered to by a court of the World Trade Organization, a body that we never got to vote on, okay, and that was slipped in on us, just like the Federal Reserve System was slipped in on us, just like the income tax was slipped in on us, okay? So, and then you look at the people and personalities behind these organizations, and you look, and they've been in control for at least 100 years, and you look back over the past 100 years, World War One, World War Two. I mean, they haven't exactly been good for us, right? But here's the main point, George. Let's assume that they do achieve their goal, and we have just one world government.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's got one of those chips, you know, and the computers keep up with everyone, and we have a one-world military force to ensure order. We have one-world economy.
One-world court, which is what they want?
Exactly. Now, what is our guarantee that some new Hitler-like tyrant won't gain control over that centralized authority and gain control of the world? Not only is there no guarantee, but we're really not even supposed to be talking about this. This is just conspiracy theory. And yet the facts are all there for anybody who wants to stop and look at them. The problem is you don't hear any of this in your corporate-controlled media because the very people who are in these secret societies own and control the four or five multinational corporations that dominate the media in this country. And I'm not just talking about the news media. I'm talking about magazines, cable, radio, TV, satellite, internet, you name it. They control this, and I should have left out internet. That's one of the few areas, you know. But they're making movements all the time to try to curtail the internet.
They are working on that. Hey, when we come back after the half hour, I want to talk with you about the XOPS program on Discovery.
You betcha. Whatever happened to that XOPS? Let's talk about it.
Yeah, you fill us in on that, and tell me again, when is this new book coming out, Jim?
The new book will be out, I believe, in September, and the title is The Terra Conspiracy, and it takes everything. It not only deals with the mysteries and the contradictions and the questions over 9/11 itself, but then goes on out into Patriot Act, Homeland Security, and then ties it into these secret societies that are trying to gain control over all our lives.
Have you changed your views on the JFK assassination over the years, or are you still standing pat?
Every year goes by, I'm just more and more firmly convinced. And that, by the way, again, a lot of people think that Kennedy and the Kennedy family were just these rich, liberal, Eastern establishment types. But once you really look at it closely, you find out that Kennedy's great-grandfather was just a poor Irish immigrant, and the Kennedys were never part of this New World Order bunch. So I think that that played a very prominent role in his assassination. He really thought he was president. People loved him. He was really going to make changes in this country for the betterment of the people, and so they had to take him out.
Didn't he want to do away with the Federal Reserve?
Well, probably, but he knew that that would have been a tough nut to crack. But it's true that in June of 1963, he ordered $6 billion issued not through the Federal Reserve System, but through the U.S. Treasury Department. In fact, I have a $5 bill in my possession, and at the top it says United States note rather than Federal Reserve note, and the ink is red rather than green. And so what's the difference? $5 is $5, right? Well, if the Federal Reserve, which is a series of privately owned banks, issues the money, then the government has to pay them interest on the money that they issue. That's what's known as the national debt. Kennedy decided, well, why don't we just print our own money, and then it's not worth any more or less, but we don't have to pay interest on it.
That's right. Stay with us, Jim. We'll be back. We'll talk about that XOPS program in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Jim, we were talking a couple months ago about the XOPS program on Discovery with you and Joshua Warren and Heidi, and nobody called me back up to update me. What happened?
Well, this is an interesting story, but let's back up even further. If you'll recall, I don't even know, it's been more than a year ago, but maybe a year and a half or so ago, I was with you, and we talked about the alien ghost at Roswell.
Yes. Right? Great story. The one in the hospital, right?
That was the wildest story I believe I've ever stumbled across, and I literally stumbled across it. I was at a medical facility there in Roswell, New Mexico, doing something totally unrelated to UFOs, and I got to talking. We asked if we could do some production work in one of their hallways, and the director there was just absolutely wonderful, and she said yes. Said, go up here on this particular hallway, and you can shoot whatever you want to up there. Said, we really just use that area mostly for storage. And then she had to add, the staff doesn't like to go up there. Well, of course, my journalistic hackles rose, and I said, why not? And come to find out, it was haunted. And so over the next few days, I went around and talked to everybody I could get hold of there at this facility. It's the New Mexico Rehabilitation Center. It's where they it's a state-owned facility, and that's where they send people for physical therapy and various things. And they all had heard the story of this hallway that was haunted, and people had heard footsteps up there where nobody was there. The elevators opened and closed. Lights would go off and on. People encountered intense spots of cold, just your typical haunting stories. But the thing that really got me on this one was when I finally talked to some people who had actually seen this apparition, and then some of the people also talked about this, is that this particular ghost, or whatever it was not human. It was small, about 4 foot tall, with a great big head, big dark eyes, and I'm going, holy cow, it sounds like a description of an alien. And then I did some checking, and I found out that this has only been the New Mexico Rehabilitation Center since about 1967 or so, and before that it was the Air Force base, okay? It was the Walker Air Force base.
Okay.
And then I found out that this particular brick facility had been built about 1950, and it had been built over the exact same location of the old wooden Roswell Army Airfield Hospital, which, according to the stories, is where they took the dead aliens from the infamous 1947 Roswell crash.
Good point.
So I'm just going, whoa, you know? So we come forward now. And I began working as a co-producer with some other people. And we managed to secure a deal with Discovery Channel, okay? And we were talking about doing a kind of a reality TV series where we would take a team of investigators representing a wide variety of disciplines, and we'd go out and investigate some of the really weird stories that were floating around, and we immediately decided that we wanted to go check on the alien ghost in Roswell. Now, we had no preconceived ideas, and we had production money, and we assembled a team of investigators that included a couple of young guys. Josh Warren was one of them,
yep.
with and he's heavy into the high-tech, you know, technologies, got plasma meters. And
oh, he loves his ghost equipment, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, he's got all that stuff. And having met and worked with him, he's open-minded, but he's very scientific. He doesn't just jump at anything that comes along. We also had one of the directors of MUFON, okay, with one of probably the most prestigious UFO organizations. We had an Indian shaman, and we had a couple of psychics who had good track records. And we took all this equipment, and we went to Roswell, and my greatest fear was that the people at the hospital would kind of get cold feet and didn't want to talk to us and didn't want to tell about all the stories they had.
That's always a possibility.
Always. And then the next fear was is that we get there with all this equipment and there wouldn't be anything there, you know. And but, George, it turned out quite the contrary. The people at the hospital all were very gracious. They all told us their stories. One woman, her mother had worked there even. She'd been there about 20 years, and her mother had been there 20 years before. So 40 years back, the story of the alien ghost was still going on. So it is not a recent thing. It goes all the way back almost to the time of the 47 Roswell crash. Everybody experienced this thing. I don't have to tell you about production crews. I'm sure you've been around them. These guys, they go from one production to another, sound men, cameramen, grips, you know, and they get pretty jaded, you know.
No emotion.
They've seen it all, and they don't they're not awed by movies or TVs or productions, because that's their profession. They do it all the time. These guys were freaking out. It was obvious that there was something there, okay? And the cameras, the video cameras, caught floating orbs of light going down and through some of the rooms and in the hallways. And the psychics were just going ballistic. Neither one of them had known each other prior to meeting out here, and yet they both began to tell the same story from the standpoint of the alien. And he described to them in some detail what had happened, how he came to be involved in the crash, what happened afterwards, you know. And, of course, that's just a story, I understand. But then we were picking up this stuff on video. The sensors were going wild. One of the things that happened that really impressed me was we were asking the psychics. Both of them were saying, yes, that the alien apparition, the being, whatever, he's here right now. And we said, well, we, you know, we're looking around. We didn't see anything. And we said, well, where is he? And they both turned and pointed to a inbuilt metal and glass cabinet, you know, like you'd put medical supplies in over against one wall. And they said, he's standing right in the middle of that cabinet. And I can't remember now. One of the fellows, might have been Josh, had this plasma meter, and he immediately runs over there and sweeps the plasma meter along the medical cabinet, and it went from green, 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 green. It started getting close to the middle. It went yellow, yellow, and when it got to the middle, it went red, 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 and then he kept sweeping it and went yellow, yellow, and back to green, 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 green. And so the instrument was picking up some sort of plasma reading in the middle of this cabinet at the exact location where the psychics are saying that's where the apparition is standing right this minute. It was an incredible experience, and so much so they even went to the original hangar and investigated there. There were things that happened there. They went to the UFO museum there in Roswell, and some incredible things happened there. They picked up, while they were all sitting around having, I guess, kind of a seance, the camera was picking up this whitish, cloudy form floating and moving behind them. And nobody ever noticed that until we looked at the video. And, you know, we're talking about professional people here. They know what lens flare is and everything else.
Absolutely.
And this was something else. And while they were there, there was just this banging noise, which you can clearly hear on the video, as if somebody was on the roof hitting something or throwing a garbage can around or something. It was just this huge banging. And there was nothing there, and there was nothing to create that sound up there. It was one of the most amazing experiences that I've ever had in my life. Okay? Now, so what happened? So we all come back. Everybody,
so it sounds like you got a great pilot here, right?
Exactly. And everybody was so fired up and jazzed because, I mean, you know, this was it. And the thing is, we went out. We were ready to debunk something if it turned out to be nothing there or if it was some kind of a hoax or whatever. But this was all very real. And all of a sudden, strange things began. So we came back, and everybody was fired up, and Josh Heide came on your program. I was on your program. We were all talking about this. Everybody got excited. And then you just wouldn't even believe it. All of a sudden, everything goes doggo. The network executive producer who had been assigned to our production just suddenly picked up and left with no explanation, no word, wouldn't talk to us. Nobody was sent to replace her. And then all of a sudden, just weeks went by, no word, nobody had any word. And finally, one network executive said, well, you don't really expect us to believe all this, do you? Okay? And then they came and tried to get us to change the narrative of the program or the program itself and actually and try to make fun of these people, make fun of the people at the hospital, and we refused to do that. And so at that point, they said, well, you all just believed in all this stuff, and you didn't, and there was nobody there to debunk it, so there's no journalistic objectivity. Well, excuse me, we didn't go out there to create a controversy or whatever. We went to see if there was something there, and there was. And everybody, including the production crew, experienced this and knows that it happened. And yet, boom. It's not on the air, it's not going to be on the air.
They didn't even take it to the pilot stage where you finished it?
Of course we had a finished production ready to go, and they just said no. So, you know, I don't know. That's exactly what happened. I can't tell you anything past that. If any of your listeners are interested as I am as to learn why Discovery would not air this incredible program, I suggest that they call 240-662-2000, 240-662-2000, which is the general offices of Discovery. Ask for the general manager and just ask them, why didn't you air this and let us make up our mind whether it's real or not?
I would have really wanted to have seen that that ghost story.
Oh, it's incredible. You know, I mean, I have a copy of the finished program, and it's just amazing. And there are, here's the photographs. Here's the people talking. You can hear the sounds in the background. You can see the floating orbs of light floating through the room. I mean, it was really incredible. And then for somebody somewhere to say, oh, no, I don't buy that. We're not going to show that. A big discovery, right?
And the fact that the executive producer was gone,
yeah,
fired
just
or otherwise, that hurt. I'm sure that probably hurt a lot, didn't it?
Oh, of course. Well, there was then nobody there to act as the liaison between our production and Discovery. And the whole thing just went down the drain with very little explanation. It's just very strange. It is very strange. And then, of course, that leads us back into our topic of conversation, which is, are there people who control at the very top of these media organizations who know better than to allow some of this esoteric reality to get to the average guy on the street? I recall... George, your memory will be better than mine, but don't you recall when Richard Hoagland, I think you were interviewing, and you all talked about how that he had figured out that a lot of the NASA space shots, but even including the Apollo missions, had been set, launch dates had been set to coincide with the alignment of the stars.
Yeah, oh yeah, he had some incredible theories about what NASA was up to. You're
exactly,
right.
And I followed that some, and there was a NASA scientist or engineer, a guy at work for NASA, who thought that that sounded pretty outlandish, so he went back and checked and did a study, and he was absolutely shocked and amazed to find out that Hoagland was absolutely right.
I think Richard also believed in a secret society within NASA.
Well, think about it. Since that was confirmed by a NASA employee, too, then just think what this means. Somewhere there is someone with enough power to set the launch dates for NASA space missions who is using the alignment of the stars, astrology, if you will, to guide that decision. Now, that's just amazing to me. Especially having grown up in the 50s and 60s when science was everything. And, you know, we didn't believe in psychic ability. We didn't believe in extraterrestrials, UFOs. None of that's real, okay? If you couldn't hold it in your hand and measure it, it didn't exist. And yet, here we are. And I would venture to say, I don't know this, but I would venture to say that whoever this person or these persons are who are setting these NASA space missions based on the alignment of the stars have some sort of occult knowledge and certainly interest and are powerful enough to set our space mission. So we're right back, and they're probably members of one or the other of these secret societies. And, of course, since they're secret, you don't hear about them, but yet they are powerful enough to start wars. You can learn all about that in my book, Ruled by Secrecy, and to set NASA space missions. It's an amazing story that most people don't even know about, and most people would turn their head and say, oh, I don't want to listen to that. That's just balderdash. But, George, that's what they count on, the disbelief of the public.
What can people do about all of this, Jim? You know, we give them incredible information, and then I don't want to leave them hanging.
Exactly.
What can they do?
Well, number one, educate yourself. And that means don't listen to the 6 o'clock news and read your local newspaper and believe that you are truly informed. You're going to have to go out. Even the Bible states, seek the truth and ye shall find it. Doesn't say listen to some newscaster. It says seek the truth. You're going to have to go out and you have to do some reading. You have to do some studying. You have to buy some DVDs. You're going to have to get on the internet. And for goodness sakes, don't go to the places and read the books and look at the shows that you agree with. Go out and listen to everybody. Listen to what everybody's saying. And I'll tell you what I found, George, in my 40 some odd years of journalism, is that if you will listen to all sides of a topic and gather in as much information as you can, the hoaxes, and the lies and the deceit tend to fall away pretty quick. You've been in journalism for years, George, and don't you, would you agree that when you go to investigate a story and somebody tells you something that sounds wild, that's a big story, but you go out and you can't find anybody else to corroborate it, and you can't find any evidence to substantiate it, then pretty quickly you realize that that's just a story, right?
Exactly. And then, though, when you begin to investigate a very strange story, but you begin to hear pieces from other people, you begin to realize that something happened. And, you know, I use that with the Jimmy Hoffa story, Jim. Mm-hmm. I was one of the last reporters to talk to him before
really?
He disappeared in 1975. Yeah, I was walking him. We had just done a show with him, and he was talking about how he wanted to come back and regain the Teamster presidency.
Right.
I was walking him to his car. It was just me and him right at the back of the lot of our television station at the time. It was WJBK, which was at that time a CBS affiliate, Channel 2 in Detroit. And I'm walking him out there. We're talking for about a half hour. And then sure enough, a few months later, he's gone. But we had built up enough contacts to realize that there were specific reasons why they got rid of him.
Right.
And like
and
you
one
said,
of the specific reasons was because he was trying to regain control of the Teamsters.
Absolutely. He had decided to go straight after being involved with these thugs for so many years. Stay with us. Our guest is Jim Marrs. It'll be your turn now. Phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Jim Marrs, our guest, and your phone calls. Jim, you ready for the onslaught of calls?
Well, can I say something before we get to the calls?
Oh, absolutely, sure.
Yeah, this is a little caveat. After each time I'm always on your program, I just get deluged with emails and calls and people, you know, some pro, some con questions. And I've always tried to make it a point to try to respond to people if I can. But I just got to say that don't expect any immediate replies, because I am going to be running over about the next 2 to 2.5 weeks. On the weekend of May 27th, 28th, I'm going to be at the Conspiracy Con 2006 there in the Bay Area with a really outstanding group of people, Will Thomas, Dr. Stan Monteith, Ted Gunderson, a lot of people, and there's going to be a lot of conspiracy talk going on, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
And
yeah.
Where's that going to be? That's going to be at the Hyatt Regency. And then the next weekend, I'm heading to Chicago for a 9/11 conference entitled 9/11 Revealing the Truth, Reclaiming Our Future at the Chicago O'Hare Rosemont. That'll be June 2nd and 4th at the Embassy Suites Hotel. So anyway, there's a lot of stuff going on, and of course, after, you know, what we talked about at the beginning of the program, I'm sure at both the Conspiracy Con and the 9/11 conference up in Chicago, you know, there'll be a lot of grist for the mill, but don't expect a quick reply from me.
But it will come.
But it will come, if at all possible.
Let's go to the phones. Wild Card Line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yes, sir.
It is indeed an honor. I am so happy I could get through to speak to you and Jim. My name is Steve. I'm calling from Danville, Virginia. I had the honor of meeting Jim several years ago in Charlotte, North Carolina, along with David Icke, and he was very cordial and answered many of my questions. I had just started to awaken. I'm a retired Marine officer, and the 2001 incident really caused me to stop and take some strong looks at what was going on. And Jim, thank you so much for your book on that subject, and you know, the rule by secrecy, the alien agenda. You guys have just both opened my eyes so much to what's going on in the world, and I don't have any questions. I just wanted to say that, and I'm deeply honored to be able to speak to both of you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Steve, very nice. And I'm sure I speak for George too.
Absolutely. You know, Jim, you know, you've been a journalist for a long time, and I think it's important for everybody to understand that when you come up with your thoughts and your theories, it's based on interviews and a lot of hard work. This is not fiction.
That's true, George. I do not just sit around in a chair and say, hey, what if this is, you know, come up with some theory. What I do is what all good journalists do. I follow the evidence. And usually that means the old journalistic adage, follow the money, right?
East of the Rockies, your turn with Jim Mars on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing? This is Brian from Maryville, Indiana.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for calling.
Howdy, Brian.
Thank you. Hi, guys. I have a question, George. About a year ago, you had a story about a find under the Berlin Airport about possible UFO evidence or designs or...
It was old World War II planes.
Okay.
That they had found down there.
Okay.
In perfect condition.
Okay, that's what it was.
Yeah.
I also wanted to ask Jim Marr, do you have a website? And has anyone ever told you you sound like Billy Bob Thornton when you're on the radio?
No, that's a new one for me.
Do you have a website?
That's a compliment.
And what was your question there, Brian?
Just if he has a website.
Oh, yes. He sure does. Go ahead, Jim.
JimMarrs.com.
Okay.
JimMarrs.com. I've been pointed out several times by people saying, you talk and you write about UFOs and your name's Mars. I guess that may be kind of weird.
You know, I noticed that when I first started talking to you, that your name was perfect. Now, some people get you confused for Tex Mars.
Right.
Any relation?
I have been in touch with Tex Mars, and he seems like a really affable gentleman. And it is kind of odd that two fellows named Mars with the same spelling both write about the New World Order and both are based in Texas. But, George, to the best of our knowledge, there is no relationship there. Although he also knew about the Mars Castle in Scotland and said his ancestors came from Scotland and my ancestors came from Scotland and I knew about the Mars Castle. So I don't know. There might be something back in there.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. Hi, George. My name is Bob. I'm calling from Mesquite, Nevada. And a strange coincidence, I just left Maryville, Indiana to drive here. I arrived this Friday. Your last caller called from Maryville, Indiana. It's strange. We didn't coordinate, honestly. Anyway, Jim, I've talked to you three times. The first time I met you was in Aztec. Anyway, the reason I'm calling tonight is that I'm surprised that you would be surprised that Discovery would do something like that with you. My experience or my feeling about all these TV media, the whole media, is that it lies about everything. And I've got one thing you would think they'd never bother to lie about. The history of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Both the movie and the A&E channel and the History Channel totally distorted the history. They all say that Butch and Sundance died in South America. They didn't. They came back to the U.S. and died here.
You know, hey, Bob, you know how I know that's not true? Is because they used to hang out in Hell's Half Acre in Fort Worth, Texas, my hometown. And there are reports that they were seen in Hell's Half Acre long after they supposedly were killed by the Bolivian army.
Well, see here. Now, I know a mechanic, he's my age, in Mesquite here named Charles. I shouldn't give his last name because I didn't ask his permission. But his grandmother was 3 years old in a Mormon camp on the Mexican side of the border when Butch and Sundance came back and protected that camp for about 2 weeks from Pancho Villa. And then there's another famous guy in St. George, Utah, by the name of Bart Anderson. He's quite a historian. And he interviewed Butch Cassidy's widow when she was aged 104. And he is, he believes he's buried up in Leeds, Utah, which is 50 miles from where I sit. And his family name was Parker, and he believes he's in an unmarked stone in their family plot. Sundance died in 1951 in federal prison, according to Bart Anderson's I videoed his hour-long presentation 3 years ago. He's got all the details. The head of the gang was a graduate of Harvard University who got caught because Butch and Sundance would lay off, and this other guy that got caught would not. What's also is very strange is that after he got out after 7 years in prison, He went and got another degree in geology and made the first oil find in Utah, which he didn't profit from. And then he went to, migrated to Los Angeles and became the water commissioner. And I think his date of being the water commissioner coordinates with the character played by John Huston in Chinatown, although I'm sure the story's not the same. But that's pretty bizarre.
Well, okay, you know, that's an interesting story.
We could spend the next 3 days here talking about things like that, but the bottom line is that most of the thing people think is true is simply not true. If we had the time, I could tell you that Jesse James was not shot by the dirty little coward. He lived for many years. John Dillinger, that was not John Dillinger that was shot outside the Biograph Theater. And that John Wilkes Booth, the man that was shot in the barn in Virginia, was not the real John Wilkes Booth, and that he didn't die until 1908. And there's several other stories I could tell. It's really funny, but history just has a way of being written by whoever's in power and whoever wants to tell the story.
Well, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're up. Hi there.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. Thanks.
Hey, Jim, a long time no talk. I worked with you on X-Ops.
Who's this?
One of the camera guys. I was production coordinator, Tim.
Oh, yes. Hey, Tim.
How are you doing?
I bet you've been wondering whatever happened to that
show. You know what? I'll tell you what. This is so honest. I was reliving some photographs tonight, kind of working late on the computer, and I was looking all at the X-Ops sticks. And I said, you know what? I got to turn on the radio. I had no clue you were on tonight. I had listened to the last broadcast you were on. And, you know, it just, I turned it on. We're listening to you, and you were talking about the hangar. And I was running an infrared camera on the hangar when we had all kinds of crazy things going on.
Well, thank you for backing me up on this because, I mean, it sounds crazy. And a lot of people would think, oh, they're just telling some stories. But, hey, Tim, you were there. You felt it, right?
You know what? I'll tell you what. I think the three probably, the one that stand out is probably when we were in the hangar, when we were actually in the museum, because the museum was a lot of history and information like that. But then all of a sudden we decided to shoot an interview, and things started going crazy. There was a map that had all kinds of sightings. And the lady who actually is a curator of the museum said, I've never seen these lights going as crazy as they are tonight.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I understood that they saw lights over there where there wasn't any lights.
Yes, yes. And then there was just all kinds of crazy. I mean, we literally had our psychics were just getting all kinds. And all the electronic guys, Josh. We're just getting readings that were going haywire.
That's right. They were just pegging those instruments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was just really an amazing thing, wasn't it? And it just, I don't know. It just disgusts me as a journalist that some corporate type at Discovery would say, well, I don't think I believe that, so we will keep that off the air.
Yeah, yeah. And hopefully I've been talking to producers lately, and they're shopping it. It's being taken around.
So it may not be a dead issue.
I hope it's not a dead issue.
I think so too.
You know, there was a lot of facts that came out. The team that was put together is a very, very knowledgeable team in a lot of areas, and Roswell is just the beginning of this X-Ops team.
Yep, you're right, and that's why I hope that concept can be brought forward, because so often on some of these programs, they'll tell you the story, but there's never any real effort to go out and investigate and find out if the story's true or false or what.
Well, what was such just an interesting part of working on this, I've always been a believer in different areas, and working with this team, there were so many different concepts and different points of view in all kinds of areas, from the scientific side to just the personal side when it came to the psychics and everybody else involved.
Exactly. That really impressed me, too, because, you know, that's the way to get to the truth of an issue is through a multidisciplinary approach.
Yes, and shows like this, George, I mean, you know, I work during the day, but when I can catch you at night and the guests that you have, it's phenomenal. I love the
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it. And keep up the good work. Are you in the L.A. area?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we got to get together when I get back home.
I will, sir.
Good to hear from you, Tim.
Thanks. See you, Jim.
You know, I might have something for you, Jim, when I get back, and I'll call you because I've stumbled into some contacts up there that might be very interested in doing something.
Great. Great. You know, there's so much stuff that needs to get out to people, but, you know, the old saying, you got to have money to make money.
Well, you know, it's a good idea. Most of the networks should take a plunge on something like this, considering some of the stuff that's been on television recently.
Really? And hey, George, I don't know if you're as old as I am, but I can remember back in the 50s when they were calling television the vast wasteland.
What do you mean you don't know how old I am? I was the one that relayed the message from Marconi.
Oh, that's right.
Way before television, James.
That's right. It was Mr. Watson come in here and bring George Norrie with you.
Yeah, that's right. First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yes, hey, gentlemen. How are you tonight?
Good, sir. Thank you.
All right. I'm a first time caller, but I've been listening and to you, George, for a couple years now.
Well, thank you.
Really enjoying the show every night. And also, with Mr. Mars, I'm a big fan of yours. I've read everything that you've written. I also really enjoyed your Secret of Redgate film you did a couple years ago.
Yes, that was pretty interesting too, wasn't it?
Yes, I love that. I'm wondering if you're going to be in the movies anytime soon again, anything like that.
Well, you know, there has been some talk of going back to Redgate. What I can tell you is this, is that they are still experiencing UFO activity and occurrences and incidents up there in the Redgate area, up there in Montana.
Oh, that's excellent. Also, I wanted to let you know, I jotted down the number you read off earlier for the Discovery Channel guy. I'm going to give him a ring in the morning.
Well, that'd be great. Yeah, give a call there at 240-662-2000.
2000? That's it. Oh, I know what I'm doing.
I mean, I'm not trying to raise Cain here. I seriously would like to know, when we go out trying to do an honest, objective investigation and we come up with some really incredible and strange phenomena, I would really like to know why they don't want to hear that.
Apparently,
no explanation.
And apparently you've got some pretty good stuff on tape.
Some incredible stuff. And, George, you know me and you know my work, and you know that I don't just run off after every little, flaky story or some claim or whatever. I mean, I do my homework.
Yeah, you do. You're very thorough about that, and that's... I guess in one respect, that's what upsets me about this 9/11 investigation, because you don't make many mistakes, Jim.
No.
And I kind of wish that you and some of these other people are wrong. I don't think you are, though.
Well, believe it or not, sometimes I wished I was wrong. You know, for 42 years now, I've been perfectly willing to entertain the idea that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy all by himself. But the problem is, the evidence does not point to that.
No, I know that, and it's it is. Well, let me ask you this about that real quickly before we go to the break and come back with more calls. Why have they sealed all the important documents in that case? You know, they're going to be released when 50 years from now or something like that.
Yeah, 2029 or something like that. But it's probably a variety of reasons. But I think the primary reason is that if all the evidence was out there in front of everybody, serious and studious researchers would be able to put it together and would have a much more clear picture of what actually happened. And you know, George, here's what bothers me. At least the Warren Commission, when they issued their bogus report, a few months later they issued 26 volumes, 26 books filled with just good, bad, and indifferent information, but at least they put it out there. Now, researchers found that in their volumes, the evidence and testimony and everything very often did not did not support their conclusions.
Right.
But let me tell you, here's how bad it is today. The 9/11 Commission report comes out, issues their bogus report, and we got nothing. We got no 26 volumes. We got no raw documents or raw data. We got no testimony. You know, we got virtually nothing. In fact, I came across a quote from Condoleezza Rice the other day that I just have to pass along with you. In 2004 on 60 Minutes, she told Ed Bradley, she said, well, the 9/11 Commission rightly did not concentrate on what happened on September the 11th.
Rightly?
Rightly. They were right not to concentrate on what happened on 9/11. And here's the 9/11 Commission, but they didn't concentrate on what happened on 9/11. Is that amazing?
What did they do for all those months? Stay with us. We'll be back with final questions with Jim Mars. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Jim Mars, when you were growing up, did you have this healthy skepticism about things? Did you always not take things at the face value?
Actually, yes, George. I can remember I had a lot of problem in Baptist Sunday school because, you know, I'd say, hey, you're telling us this, but over here it says this, you know, and I feel kind of bad about that now because back then, you know, it was the Sunday school teacher, but now I realize that, you know, when the guy wasn't teaching Sunday school, he's probably driving a truck or digging a ditch or something.
Right, he was volunteering his time.
And he was, and he was probably just keeping one chapter ahead of us in the book, you know. But, yeah, I've always had a very healthy skepticism of just about everything. Although, as a kid in the 40s and the 50s, you know, I was of the era that you trust the government, the policeman's your friend, all that. And, frankly, I wish we could get back to that, but we're going to have to clean things up first. And I guess really it was the Kennedy assassination, and somewhere along about 1972, in the fall of 72 after the Watergate break-in, that it became clear that Nixon was lying about that, and that was a real revelation for me because, you know, hey, if the President of the United States will lie to you about something, then, you know, what's safe, you know?
Yeah, well, it seems the older we get, the more sinister we become in terms of what they tell us, what we believe, and you're right. I think once Kennedy was assassinated, it changed the perspective. I think we lost
downhill.
Something. Yeah, we
downhill.
Lost a piece of ourselves that day,
yeah.
And we've never been able to replace it, ever.
That's true. But now I would point out to the people who say, well, you know, you're just against the government, blah, blah, blah. Hey, go back to the time of the Kennedy assassination, and we were just coming off of World War II and Korea, and everyone had unlimited faith and confidence in the United States government. Exactly what every politician today, it was exactly what they could have hoped for. And why did that change? Did the people of this country suddenly wake up and say, gee, I don't think I trust the government anymore? Or was it because the government lied to us over and over and over again to the point to where people who live through it say, you just can't trust them anymore?
Absolutely. On the line with us, by the way, Jim, is your former Sunday school teacher, no, I'm kidding. Wild card line, let's go to you. You are on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead. Where are you calling from?
Indianapolis.
All right, go ahead, please.
Yeah, a couple years ago, I was a witness to what could only be described as a dry run for a terrorist act. And I spent 2 hours of being scared out of my wits, thinking we weren't going to get off that flight alive. So we made it to the airport. The airline personnel said, "Your connecting flight's loading. You got to get out of here."
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, I just wanted to run. And the flight crew, I didn't have a lot of faith in them anyway, because at one point when we were on the taxiway, one of the individuals got up out of their seat, went to the front of the plane. FAA regulations say anybody getting out of their seat, the plane must come to an immediate stop. And they did nothing. They sat there and let this person approach them.
What did he want?
I don't know. The way the seats were, I was in last row of first class. So people in front of me couldn't see what these people were doing. They had the curtain closed, so nobody in coach could see what was going on. I'm the only person who can see what's going on. So I get home, and I'm just sick to death. The next day I call the FBI, and they treated me like, you're a wacko. Are you on medication? Have you ever been in a mental institution? That sort of thing. And I just felt like I wasn't getting anywhere. And now I'm worried to death. I'm the only person who'd seen this. A couple of days later, I was at a meeting with a high-level airline executive with a different airline. And I approached them and talked to them, and they said, what you saw is significant. You have got to talk to the FBI again.
And when was this, dear?
A couple of years ago.
So well, this, anyway, this was after 9/11?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Yes. It involved one of the airports involved in 9/11, et cetera, et cetera. The flight path was over Washington, D.C.
And how many people were involved, do you think?
Two for sure. And so the day after I reported this to the FBI, they made public that that weekend there was an extremely high-level danger alert for terrorists. So I called them back. I said, you will listen to me. I will say what I have to say. They didn't want to listen to a description, distinctive tattoos, nothing. So I just said, I want this on record because I know you're probably recording the call and all. And I just want all this on record. They told me that the only thing I can do is report to that airline security that one passenger saw something that upset them. There's nothing else they could do.
Did you notice, let me ask you this, did you notice if other passengers felt a little uneasy too?
No, it was a night flight. Most people were out. All the seats weren't filled. Guy next to me was sleeping.
Now, and let me ask you this. How do you know you're not being paranoid? I have to ask you that.
Well, I've had to, in previous careers, I've had to deal with criminals, insane people in hospital situations, and I know evil when I see it. I have never experienced such a feeling of evilness in my life.
Interesting.
So I said, you will listen to me. And after they told me there's nothing we can do, if anything happens, it'll be on your head because you didn't report it immediately.
Jim, the fact that this would be, and thanks for your call, 2 years ago, I mean.
Right, with supposedly all the heightened security. Of course, you know, in my book, I detail the story of in like January of 2002, just a few months after 9/11, an astute deputy sheriff in Florida stopped a pickup truck late one night, and the driver was dressed in black, had a .45 and a shoulder holster, had a shotgun in the back seat, and bomb-making materials. So needless to say, they arrested him. Turns out he was a soldier from Fort Stewart, Georgia, which is where they train our special ops guys. And the guy's explanation was he was practicing his night maneuvers. The deputy sheriff then remembered he'd seen that pickup truck back at a Florida Power and Light station. They went back there and found an explosive device in the Power and Light station. When I called this story, somebody sent it from me from Florida because it hit the local media, and it didn't hit the rest of the national media. And I'm just going, well, that's odd because, you know, when this heightened awareness of terrorism, and here they catch a terrorist and nothing said. And then I called down there and talked to the reporter who had was covering this, and she said, boy, this is really strange that they have yet. This is like 2 weeks later, and they still hadn't even brought the guy into court. And so I began to think, you know, this is either a case where you've got a real nutcase that managed to get into the armed forces, in which case you'd think that they'd throw the book at him just as an example of what they're going to have, little tolerance they're going to have for terrorists, or this guy's following orders and carrying out some kind of black operation, in which case you're never going to hear about this again. And I ask you, you ain't never heard about it again, have you, George?
No, sir, we have not.
There's we have got to figure out who's really in charge in this country. It's not the Congress and it's not Bush. Okay, we've got to find out who's really in charge if we ever expect to turn things towards the public good.
They might not even be in this country, Jim.
They probably aren't. That's, you know, money talks, and the central bank of this country is the Federal Reserve System, but it's not part of the government and it has no reserves. It's 12 member banks who in turn are owned by private banks who in turn are owned by private investors, many of whom are not Americans.
I had Andy Russo on yesterday, a film producer who is talking about how he believes that, you know, the government is just pushing us in the wrong direction. frightening, some of the things he said.
Well, it is, and the thing is, nothing is going to be done about it until people wake up and realize that that they're having the wool pulled over their eyes and that these types of things are going on and are being manipulated or being created, and that there is an agenda in play here.
First-time caller line, welcome to the program. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, sir. Good, good, good.
I'm calling from North Carolina. Hey, Jim.
Howdy.
You know how you were talking about how you sound like the ghost apparition or what have you in Roswell, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, have you noticed how technology has boomed dramatically since then, right?
That's right.
Have you ever thought that maybe they had several aliens that maybe wanted to or have you survive? And maybe they're, like, answering to him because it's like all this stuff that they're finding, it's like they know exactly where to look and everything for it.
Well, and you know that there have been a lot of people in the know, like Colonel Corso and even Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, who publicly stated that some of our modern technology has come from the Roswell crash.
Isn't it interesting, Jim, how that when all the astronauts who went to the moon and came back, all of them were affected in some dramatic way.
That's right. That's right. And unlike Charles Lindbergh, who was paraded from town to town and ticker tape parade to ticker tape parade, most of those astronauts have kept a very, very low non-public profile.
Well, and that's probably by design, don't you think?
Absolutely. They don't want them just talking about anything. I know I met with Dr. Mitchell at one point, and we were sitting, having just kind of a social setting.
Yeah.
And I was kind of biting my lip because I really wanted to ask him about aliens, but I didn't want to offend him, and I didn't want to get in his face about something that he might think was just really oddball or whatever.
Well, I had him as a guest on the program a couple of years ago.
Right. Well, this was back before he became more public. But
right.
Somebody else at the table with us broached the subject, and then he jumped right in the middle of it. And then I was adding in, and it suddenly dawned on me, I'm sitting here talking to the sixth astronaut that walked on the moon, and we're talking about aliens, space aliens, as calmly and matter-of-factly as if we were discussing the weather.
Isn't that something?
I mean, you know, he's not snickering. He's not rolling his eyes.
Dead serious.
He's dead serious, and he knows that it's all very real.
Next up, let's go to our next wild card line. Your turn. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah.
This is Dan calling from North Carolina.
Howdy, Dan.
Hello, Jim. I have a friend who is associated with Discover, and I wanted to share with you and the audience something that he told me was said, and I suspect you know it, and you may not have said anything. He said something about the fact that a show like this about the paranormal to the executives now there was something that should be watered down and dumped on the Travel Channel for the idiot paranormal people. Did you hear that?
Yes, I've heard that. And it's really interesting. And that fits in with the fact that they came back to us as producers and wanted us to water down the program. They wanted us to make fun of the people we were interviewing. You know, kind of a Penn and Teller type thing. Just rake them over the coals, you know. And I'm sorry, but I'm not going to do that when somebody tells me something in all sincerity.
I think that what was done here is an insult not only to you guys after appearing, you know, on Coast to Coast, but to every single Coast to Coast listener. So I'm kind of hoping, and I already see, that on Discovery.com, their website, that some people have posted some kind of nice messages. That, you know, tomorrow morning, the website is, I mean, we got 10 million people here. I would like to see everybody either calling or on the website kind of sharing with them, you know, that this is not so cool. What do you think?
I just want to know what their thinking is. I mean, we were just kind of like dropped with no real explanation. And I would like somebody, you know, if they want to tell me that, hey, it's our channel and we'll decide what people are going to see and what they're not going to see, at least that's an explanation.
Well, but do that at the outset. Don't do it after you fund a pilot.
Exactly. And George, everybody was so excited going into this thing because it had all the elements. We were going into strange stories, and yet we were going in objectively, and we had a whole team of people, multidisciplinary, and we were going to truly investigate these things, you know? And how many times have you and your listeners seen something on History or Discovery or A&E, and they say UFOs, and they show a saucer flying around, and you go, wow, and then you tune in, and the first 10 or 15 minutes, it's like, some people say there's UFOs, and some people say they're hovering around the Earth, and some people say aliens are amongst us now, and then they go on, and then by about the middle of the show, they're into their same old trite experts going, nothing there, folks, nothing there, folks. And all of a sudden, it's just like, you know, they build you up, titillate you to get the listenership, and then feed you this line about it's not happening. It's propaganda is what it is.
Let's go to our final call here, James. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. This is Dorothy in Washington State.
Hi, Dorothy. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I have a question. I tuned in when you were talking about the 9/11 and the airplanes that were non-existent or whatever. I didn't get all of it. But and going into the Pentagon, what I'm wondering is what happened to all these people that were on the airlines and people who called, you know, from their cell phones to their families. What's become of that?
Exactly, and those are very good questions. There is just a lot of controversy like that. It was only in 2004 that they came out with a big announcement that they had finally come up with a chip that allowed cell phones to operate from a high-flying aircraft. In 2001, and I have checked on this and checked on this, and to the best of my knowledge, it was impossible to make a cell phone call from an airliner, okay, over about 8,000 feet. And these planes were at, 30,000, 35,000 feet. And then you have a problem with trying to connect to the towers. You know, about the time that your cell phone would connect to one of those telephone towers, you'd be past it and gone again. But you have to understand, with digital technology, all I have to do is have a sampling of your speech, and I could have you saying anything. Okay, and this again has to do with all this exotic technology that is being secretly worked on in this country and around the world that the public simply doesn't know about.
Jim Mars, thanks for being on the program, Jim.
It's always a pleasure, George. Let's do it again sometime.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.